There was the tree we had established as a landmark. There could be no mistake. This was the same place. I grew excited, though I tried to mask my enthusiasm. We examined the field. It had been plowed up since the explosion, that could have obliterated most of the signs. I looked at the largest tree again. It had been burned slightly, and one of the branches had been broken. Thinking to myself, I guessed the damage might have been caused by an observation disc sent out by a control ship. Perhaps the small disc had got out of control and was exploded before it could do any serious damage. Perhaps it had been heading directly toward the car when it was harmlessly destroyed. As we drove home, my brother-in-law wanted to discuss the incident further, along with various subjects relating to space travel and the possibility that other planets were inhabited. As I talked with him, I realized that many people were growing interested in such previously ridiculous subjects. Again, I could see the great wisdom of the space people. Their asking me to wait before I told my story was wise indeed. Perhaps they were waiting until an increasing awareness in people made acceptance of my story more assured. I felt my way carefully in the conversation, all the while noting his reactions to different concepts I put forth. I wanted to tell him much, much more, but I could not allow him to suspect at that time my own part of and work in this field. Again, I found it extremely difficult to know a wonderful secret and be unable to share it with others. In June of the same year, one was working in the shop when I received a strong telepathic impression, but this time it was different. I had the distinct sense of hearing something like a telephone or distant radio inside my head. It was a man's voice, and it sounded like L. Howard, I am waiting for you in a car at field location, number 2, the voice said. Please come as soon as you can. I was thrilled at the prospect of seeing L again. As I hastily cleaned my brushes, I wondered how it was possible for L to communicate in that manner, for I had heard the voice distinctly, even though the location was about 9 miles from the shop. I put aside my work, got into the truck and headed for Pleasant Grove. As I approached the dirt road leading into the field, I passed the tree landmark and saw a car parked farther down the field near the trees which separated it from another field. I parked the truck and approached the car. L got out of the car and we shook hands warmly. He apologized for taking me away from my work. He said there were many ships in the surrounding area of New Jersey, New York and Pennsylvania, and there were as many people from other worlds working with the people on this planet, just as he was with me. This is only the beginning, Howard. There will be courses of instruction and processing. In fact, you will find it hard to believe some of the things you will be doing in the future, but you will be properly prepared so that you will be able to cope with these unusual tasks. I mentioned the exploding disc, and he confirmed it to have been one of their observation discs out of control. They had been operating in the area, he told me. Many people had seen the explosion, but had passed it off as a natural phenomenon. I'm sorry the tree was damaged, but the limb will be healed and it will continue to grow, he promised. I thought if these wonderful people were concerned about a lowly tree, how much more must they be concerned with their fellow men? Many more sightings would be reported in this area, he told me, as well as other places in New Jersey. That fall there would be a sighting over Washington, NJ, which would be witnessed by my friends and neighbors. The experiences my family was going through were for a purpose, he said. He understood the situation clearly and indicated that changes would occur sooner than expected. I asked him when we would meet again, but he said he did not know at that time. I would have other contacts, he promised, who would instruct and guide me in carrying out my work. He suggested I no longer discuss the incident of the exploding disc with the family. As we left the area, I headed west toward home and he headed east. As I drove home, all the questions I wanted to have settled came to mind. That night I could not sleep, as I thought and wondered. Who were these people? Where did they come from? Why were they here? Why did they contact me? How were they able to communicate over long distances, from one mine to another? What method of propulsion did they use? Questions. These and many other thoughts crowded out sleep. 9. Strange instruments. In August 1953, I again drove up to field location number 1, and there, as I expected, was a car, a 1953 Chevrolet. It was a red and white convertible, with Pennsylvania license plates. I locked my car, walked over to the convertible and got in at the invitation of 2 men. Something about the men were different, though they were of average height, had brown hair and dark eyes, and were dressed in business suits. They must have noticed my unintended stares, if only from the corners of my eyes. Then they eased my curiosity. "We happen to be aliens," they said. I inspected the car further. Briefcases, maps and papers covered the back seats. Strange instruments on the floor then attracted my curiosity. They were box-like objects, about the size and shape of shoe boxes, apparently made from a plastic material. A coil, which reminded me of an antenna, protruded from each of the 3 objects of different size. All were the same color, a soft grayish green. I immediately guessed, and correctly as I later found out, that the color was for camouflage, and the objects were to be spotted in fields, bushes, and so on. We pulled out of the field and headed toward Easton, PA, and as we rode along we talked about many things. I was hardly prepared for the unusual things I was to learn. Previous contacts had mentioned I was not the only one working with them. Now they further confirmed this, giving me actual names of people I eventually met and recognized. Not only were they contacting people in the East, but other sections of the country as well. I remember they specifically mentioned California, New Mexico and Arizona. Not always did people know they were working with the space people, even though their contributions had been valuable. 2 men have been working with us for many years, rather indirectly, and, Howard, they don't even know it. They're being directed, but they don't know it, let alone realizing who is helping them. 3 other men they mentioned had been working independently on scientific projects and were finally contacted because of their work. Then they began to inform me of some of my own future work. My work would mushroom into a much larger scope and would take on worldwide significance. But at that time I never in my wildest dreams thought I would be making cross-country lecture tours, appearing on radio and television, meeting and talking to large numbers of the public. Neither could I foresee the opposition and persecution I would encounter almost every step of the way. As they remarked of future happenings, again I learned of the long series of instruction and training I would receive. Some of this would be immediately practical. They knew I had been a topographical draftsman in the army, but nevertheless I had a lot to learn, particularly in certain phases of mathematics such as trigonometry. It would be necessary that I be able to estimate the distance of a mountain or the height of one of their craft, for example. The reader likely can understand why the sign painting business became less and less interesting as I wanted to devote more time to this fascinating, exhilarating and humane work. More and more it was becoming difficult to fit my mind and aspirations into the cubicle of one small community after I had glimpses into the universe, its many worlds and peoples. When we arrived in Easton they pulled up at one of the restaurants at the Circle in Midtown. I noticed neither man ordered meat, but asked for vegetable platters and fruit juice. They had coffee which they took black. Feeling they were engaging in some sort of religious fast, I ordered fish, which I didn't feel would be inappropriate. Sensing I was slightly ill at ease, one of them explained their diet. "Don't think of this in the usual sense of a religious rule," he told me, "but of natural law." He continued, "The dietary customs of your various religious groups often approach, but are still misinterpretations of these natural laws. Rules of diet should never be thought of as sacrifices, but as positive contributions to health and the exercise of consideration toward lower animals. Your own diet, Howard, as the many other things you may or may not do, will be up to you. And we don't expect you to change overnight. They suggested that if one wished to change from meat-eating habits to a more humane and better diet, one should begin by eliminating first the blood-red meats, such as beef, pork, lamb, and so on. One should then turn to fish and fowl. Next, fowl should be eliminated, and finally fish. If you still feel the need of having animal protein, fish is preferable due to the lower consciousness of the animal. In time you will discover vegetables with such high protein values that you can eliminate meat altogether, as we have done on our planet. Then they talked further of their many contacts all over the world and my job in particular. One of my tasks was the mental assistance of individuals, often without their knowledge. Such could be accomplished by sound frequency waves, light waves, the use of colors and other physical means. I had always thought of such matters as being accomplished in some supernatural manner, but I was rapidly learning that the infinite creator accomplished all purposes by natural laws. Do not think of this as some artificial control of the human brain, one of the men said, as you may see in some of those horrifying science fiction pictures, though I must confess that he, and he indicated the other man, and I saw two of them on a double picture, I assume he meant to say double a feature, and rather enjoyed them, if mainly for the humor we saw in them. We do not control the brain. Such an action is not in keeping with the laws of the infinite creator. Instead, with the proper instruments and technique, you can accomplish a much larger purpose. You can release something in the brain which is already there. The instruments in the car accomplished such tasks. I would be asked to place them in four states, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania and Maryland. With each instrument would be a man or woman who would act as a human terminal in conjunction with the machine. These people would react according to their own individual brain development with the assistance of the impulses received by the machines. I didn't quite understand how it was to work, but it seemed they were trying to get across that it was necessary to have both the machine and the human mind, working in conjunction to accomplish such a purpose. A central location will be established for each instrument. The range of each instrument is about 25 miles. After you place these instruments, Howard, you will notice an immediate and obvious effect. People within our radius of 25 miles of each instrument will automatically become more aware of and conscious of their interest in space travel and in our spacecraft. They will see more of our craft because they will be looking up. Then when these people hear of your experiences, they will be inspired to come to you and offer to help you in any way they can. They had already established many bases. The one in New Jersey was, they said, within 15 miles of my home, totally unknown to anyone, except, of course, those of this planet who had been working with the space people for many years. It seemed these space friends spoke more solemnly than the others I had met, without the many flashes of humor and good nature the others had exhibited. But perhaps it was because they weren't considering me as a child any longer, and knew it would be only a short time before I must accomplish the biggest part of my task, informing others of my experiences. I was bursting to tell the world. At the same time I felt a tremendous responsibility to these people from space, as well as those on our own planet. They made me feel as if so much depended upon my skill in accomplishing some of their purposes. And I'm afraid my ego was often inflated to a great degree. Soon would come a time when all my ego would vanish as it would be quickly deflated by the continual abuse and ridicule I would suffer. You will be warned, and threatened to stop, they admonished me as they dropped me off at my home. And again, the question, do you still want to go on? And my answer, as always, yes. The next few years were uneventful. So far as contacts were concerned, though I was given a course of instruction which I do not care to divulge at this time. Because of the increase in the size of my family and added financial responsibilities, I spent most of my time working in my business, and made a comfortable living. I was to experience a period of personal loss and unhappiness. In 1954, my oldest son, Robert, became ill. He had a brain tumor and he later developed cancer. Rose was a patient and loving nurse, completely devoted to him. In September 1955, my younger brother, Alton, was killed in an automobile accident. A few weeks later, my mother left this earth. Gradual changes and upheavals in my family were to have subtle effects upon the overall picture, and with them, I believe, I learned many lessons, particularly of humbleness and the insignificance of man. During this period, I was thinking constantly of the better world which would come about, where the tasks set before man by the space people performed with dispatch and zeal. My father was now very lonely, and in October 1955, he asked us to move back to the old home place. There began a series of events which would bring worldwide attention to High Bridge 10, Barbara, to the space people. In March 1956, the telepathic invitations to contact started again. The nature of the meetings required that many of them take place at night. Often I would receive such mental impressions between 1 o'clock and 2 a.m., and, while my wife lay sleeping, I would drive away to meet the space people and be given further instructions pertaining to my work. Since I was working by day, and often up much by night, sleep and rest became a premium and a luxury. Many of my contacts were of strictly mundane nature, however. I found I was actually helping them in little material ways, and such occasions I enjoyed as much as the periods of instruction. Often I purchased clothing and took it to the points of contact. Visitors just arriving from other planets had to be attired in terrestrial clothing so they could pass unnoticed among people. Such tasks were not without their moments of humor, and I think the visitors enjoyed them as much as I did. I remember one time when I was asked to purchase several complete outfits of female clothing. Feeling it would be embarrassing and somewhat difficult to explain why I was buying so many outfits, I purchased them in separate shops. I bought what I thought was the appropriate sizes and showed up at the point of contact. The women went into the next room, from which I soon heard a series of giggles and groans. Finally, the door opened and the bras were flung out. They apologized, saying they just could not wear them, and they never had. Just why, I didn't know, and you may be certain that I felt it wise not to ask. When they had put the rest of the clothes on, they marched out and walked up and down, more amused at their new finery than proud, though I must say they exhibited natural feminine instincts in being excited about the new clothing. Once again they had difficulties, the high heels. They teetered and wobbled and suffered, but took it in good humor. They realized they would have to learn how to wear them, though they often complained, "Why can't your women wear sensible shoes?" I ran into equally unfamiliar tasks in helping the new arrivals. A man with long blonde hair, which hung to his shoulders, approached me and handed me a pair of scissors. He could not yet speak our language, as many of them couldn't at their first arrival, though they would soon learn it, and speak it fluently. This man simply pointed to his hair and sat down, and I presumed rightly that I had unwillingly become a barber. I took a handful of the finely textured hair and opened the scissors. I halted and looked at the man. His plaintive look made me feel sorry for him, for it was obvious he was proud of his beautiful hair. But at the same time it was grotesquely funny. He laughed and motioned to go through with it. I remember several occasions when I cut their hair. I don't know if they save the hair or not, however, all evidence of the meetings was always carefully gathered up by the space people before they departed. The men, particularly the ones from one of the planets outside our solar system most involved with Earth, had unusually fair skin, without hair on their arms or face, and had no need to shave. After 3 months on Earth, however, they became hairy and grew beards. Most of them waited the 3 month period so they would have beards to shave and appear more like Earth people. Some of them requested dark glasses, a few asked for dark glasses with red glass, which was difficult to obtain. I don't know why they wanted dark glasses, for those I had met previously had not worn them. There were so many things to ask about I never remembered to inquire, though I presumed the glasses were used to acclimate their eyes to the glare of the sunlight here, which probably is more intense than the light on their planets. Thus I had the opportunity to meet people from other planets in all stages of progress and development, from those who spoke no word of our language to those who spoke it fluently, scientists and technicians to helpers and assistants. I briefed them on our customs, slang and habits. Although they utilized instruments to learn a language quickly, the machines couldn't always cope with colloquialisms. And they had to pass for ordinary people. I was gratefully surprised to be of immediate help to these advanced people. Occasionally they asked me to bring food. They asked mainly for frozen fruit juices, canned fruit and vegetables, whole wheat bread, wheat germ and like. They refused to drink milk, avoided fresh oranges, lemons and grapefruit. They preferred tree-ripened fruit when I could find it. When I couldn't, they had me obtain frozen food from supermarkets. I remember one time I bought 5 bushels of tree-ripened apples from a local orchard. They tested the apples and found the mineral and vitamin content much lower than similar fruits of their planets. This was due, they said, to our poor soil. They explained that chemical fertilizers were not the correct answer to the problem of our impoverished soil, because they did not replenish the organic materials our soil sadly lacks. Most of the time they brought their own food, in a dried, preserved state. I sampled some of it and while it was tasty, it was hard and dry. I tasted other food which was delicious. They had put the dry foods through some sort of processing which returned the moisture and at the same time expanded it to its natural size and state. I ate one of their tubers which was far superior in protein and mineral content than any vegetable we now have. We could grow the same here, they said, if our soil were healthy. Their preserved foodstuff would not spoil, mold or decay, presumably would last indefinitely, ready to process and eat at any time. They never asked me to obtain any identification papers for them or to help them locate jobs. They seemed to be able to take care of such matters themselves after they had been properly acclimated and grown accustomed to our ways. Once clothed in our attire and briefed thoroughly in our customs, they were on their own, and seemed to experience no difficulties. Often I would stay with newly arrived visitors several days, helping them adjust and become familiar with the locale or town in which they were staying. I would gather information for them, such as where the post office was located, where the schools were, the source of water supply, whether there were bodies of water nearby, and so on. I thoroughly enjoyed this work, and while it did consume a great deal of my time and money, it was a pleasure, and as I briefed my friends I learned more and more from them. 11. The observation disc. On a warm, spring night between 10 o'clock and 11 p.m. in April, 1956, just after my dad, who had night employment, left for work, I received a strong impression to go up to field location number 1. To approach this hill, which is at the rear of the old home place, one must drive around the other side, where there is a plow trail leading up to the field. It was a dark night, but since I did not want to attract attention, I drove into the field for about 1,000 yards with my car lights turned off. I arrived just in time to see a craft coming in over the crest of the hill from the west. I leapt from the car, at the same time grabbing my candid camera. I snapped a picture of it. The ship took the form of a pulsating, fluorescent light, changing in colors from white to green to red. As it neared, I prepared to take more pictures. It came in slowly, at about the speed of a Piper Cub. When it was within a foot off the ground and about 100 feet from the car, it hovered, and I recognized the familiar bell shape. The pulsating colors stopped, it gave off an eerie, bluish light, and then portals appeared. It lighted the field immediately around it with a soft, subdued light, as I snapped more pictures before it landed. After it touched ground, a man appeared in front of it, and I quickly photographed his form against the backdrop of the craft. Then I walked in his direction, and he acknowledged my presence by beckoning to me. I put the camera in my jacket, walked to him and shook hands with a tall, handsome man whose blonde hair fell to his shoulders and who wore a one-piece uniform. He led me across the field, and when we were at the edge of the woods he pointed to something lying on the ground among the trees. It appeared to be a circular, translucent object about a foot thick and 3 or 4 feet in diameter. It was pulsating different warm colors. As we approached it, the colors changed from white to blue and back to white with a tinge of yellow. "Hold it, Howard," my friend warned, as he put his hand on my shoulder. "This is as close as we can go safely." I noticed his voice was rich and deep as he informed me it was an observation disc controlled remotely from the ship to our ear. "This little disc is recording all your emotions, thoughts, possible intents." I didn't feel a thing, though it was shaking to know that a mechanical device was reading my thoughts. "Don't worry," he reassured, "it's white. When it changed to white I knew you were all right." He said the same colors were being indicated on an instrument panel within the ship and would be recorded on a chart which would be kept as a permanent record. "I want you to get a good look at this thing, for you'll have to bring people up here before they'll believe you. We'll stage a test for them." He exhorted me to inform such future witnesses they must stay at least 20 feet away from the discs because of a certain amount of field radiation when the instruments were transmitting and recording. "We'll use this location as the site of an experiment. If it works out all right here, perhaps we can get some idea of what would happen if people saw this over an entire state or even the whole country. This is one thing that is strictly experimental and we have no idea of the results. We know a lot about your people, Howard, but figuring beforehand just how they will react to this is impossible even to us." I wondered why, for the first time, I had experienced an urge to photograph their craft, and for a moment had misgivings, feeling he might not approve. "Your pictures will also be a test. Eventually you are to show them around. Tell people we're from other planets and that we are not hostile. We realize we cannot convince all the people of this world at one time, it might not be a good idea, anyhow. It might come as a great shock to people in low states of evolvement. The pictures should convince anyone," I rejoined. "No, you're wrong, not everyone. The radiation of our ships will make them fuzzy, and that will do no harm. As I said, we don't expect to convince everyone immediately, nor do we want to. It will of necessity be a slow procedure." Again I was reminded that the story should not come out until the summer of 1957, and I knew he had also learned our language well, for I remember how he put it in slang, "Don't jump the gun, fellow." Should it come out before that time, I would be subjected to even a greater amount of ridicule and persecution by those who would not understand. "Goodness knows it will be difficult enough for you, Howard, even after we've got you ready for it. You must know how to present the story properly, and not spring it all at once. People just wouldn't believe you if you went about it in the wrong way and more harm would be done than good." I asked him how I should go about choosing the witnesses and was told that I would exercise my judgment and my judgment would be good. Some people would come to me of their own accord, some I would choose. I asked him about a close friend of mine, Bill Thompson, in whom I placed great trust. "Oh, Bill. We know him. In fact, we tried to contact him in 1933. Bill would believe and understand," he said, "though I was not to confide everything to him." I was glad to hear this, because ever since we were in high school together we had enjoyed a close affinity. I would be extremely happy to tell at least someone of my experiences. Our conversation was interrupted as the observation disc suddenly rose, becoming brighter as it gained altitude, and lighting up the woods beneath it as it projected patches of light and dark through the trees. It rose to about 100 feet and then went in the direction of the ship where it seemed to disappear within the craft. As we walked back, my friend explained such discs always return to the point from where they are sent out from ships on magnetic beams, similar in a way to a bowling alley where the ball returns to the bowler in a grooved channel.